The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And you know, I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Maybe at no time since the heyday of the civil rights movement has voting rights been so much in the news. For some years now, and especially since the Supreme Court struck down elements of the Voting Rights Act back in 2013, many states have made voting harder and less accessible. The measures they adopt are usually presented as ways to prevent voter fraud, but largely, if not entirely, these measures have been targeted at Democrats, and in particular, black voters who mostly lean Democratic. A deep analysis of voter suppression was published recently, and it was entitled One Person, No Vote. The author is Carol Anderson, a professor at Emory University, and in her view, race and racism remain at the dead center of the problems around voting. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi.
Now, you're talking to me now from Atlanta. And
yes.
When we heard that Stacey Abrams, who was running for governor of Georgia, herself was almost blocked from voting this November. We heard that it was only when a poll worker told her that she'd already voted absentee. And in the end, the only way she was able to cast her vote in her telling was that she understood voting laws and she was able to advocate for herself, and probably the TV cameras trailing behind her didn't hurt her case either. But that should give us some sense of how complicated things were in Georgia, no?
Oh, absolutely. And deliberately complicated. So in the areas around Atlanta and in Atlanta, there was a 4.5-hour wait time because they didn't have the power cords for the voting machines. In the Atlanta University Center, which is where you have Morehouse and Spelman and Clark Atlanta, there were 2 working machines where there were supposed to be 9 working machines.
These are predominantly black areas.
Yes. They ran out of provisional ballots. I mean, prior to that time, there's this thing called exact match, which deals with voter registration. And it says that when you register to vote, then the Secretary of State, that would be Brian Kemp's office.
Brian Kemp, who was not only running the voting system, but also Stacey Abrams' opponent in the gubernatorial race and the eventual winner.
Right. If your name doesn't, if any of the information doesn't match up exactly with that the state has in its own database, like its driver's database, then your voter registration is put in this limbo. Well, the AP found that in August or somewhere in September or so, that 53,000 voter registrations had been put in this limbo, and 70% of them were African American.
So white rage was the title of your last book, and white rage has shaped our country and our history, and it certainly shaped the 2016 election. Did you feel that white rage was a big element of the midterm elections as well?
As I define white rage, it is not what we think of in terms of like Charlottesville and the tiki torches, but it's the kind of methodical, systematic, bureaucratic power that undermines African Americans' advances. And what we see here is that rallying up to wipe out the possibility of a Stacey Abrams, to wipe out the possibility of an Andrew Gillum, to wipe out all of the kinds of remaining vestiges of Barack Obama. I mean, what you're seeing here is this kind of entrenched last gasp effort to continue to define America and American in terms of whiteness only.
Well, is it a death rattle, or is it this just going to be a persistent current forever, as long as we can imagine it in American public life?
I think part of what it's really going to take are that the majority of whites, and remember that the majority of whites who have not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1964, after Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, where the federal government put its power and authority behind recognizing African-American citizenship. That was the moment that you had the break with whites in the Democratic Party. And so it is going to require whites to move beyond this sense of a zero-sum game, that the only way that African-Americans can get will be at whites' expense. The only way that African-Americans can get to college, African-Americans can vote, African-Americans can have a job, African-Americans can have decent housing, African-Americans can have decent health care, all of that has to come at whites' expense. That is the framing that Donald Trump uses. And that's why you get the language of stolen elections. That's why that language is so powerful. It is about something being stolen from whites. And that is the conversation that whites have to have within their own communities, because this isn't about stealing from them. This is about empowering and making America stronger.
In the days before the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and between Reconstruction and then, there were all kinds of barriers to voting for African Americans, particularly in the South, mm-hmm. including, you know, being shown a jar of jelly beans and could you count the number of jelly beans in the jar, and preposterous things like that. It sounds like it is not, it's a bit more sophisticated, but the spirit of it is not a great deal different.
The spirit is the same, because the way that disfranchisement worked pre-1965, pre-Voting Rights Act, was to go after the characteristics, the societally imposed characteristics, be it illiteracy because we've underfunded black schools, be it poverty because of slavery and Jim Crow and disparate income. I mean, all of these things were designed to get around the 15th Amendment, that says that the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And so you just take the characteristics. That's what is happening now once the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act.
Is it possible to give a number to this? How many black folks in general in this country were prevented from voting, or it was made extremely difficult for them to vote? Is there any way to put a number on this?
Yes, we've got some sense of this. We know, for instance, that in Wisconsin in the 2016 election, 8% of whites and 27% of African Americans were prevented from voting because of Wisconsin's voter ID laws. And note that these states recognize this when they write these laws. North Carolina knew it when it wrote its voter ID laws, which led the Fourth Circuit to say, you have targeted African Americans with nearly surgical precision.
Now, on the other hand, did it surprise you that in Florida, which is, you know, a pretty red state, they voted to re-enfranchise felons?
And that was a long-term nonpartisan movement, grassroots movement, that managed to frame that narrative that these are people who have served their time. They have paid their debt to society. How long are we going to continue to punish them? And so they were tapping at these multiple narratives in American society. And that felony disfranchisement law came out of Reconstruction in Florida in 1868. Mm-hmm. And it was a response to the Reconstruction Act of 1867 that provided that African American men had the right to vote. And so you see this kind of backlash against black voting, and that's what the felony disfranchisement law did.
Mm. Now, since the 2016 election,
mm-hmm.
we've heard a lot about what Democrats need and should do to win in 2020, and a lot of that talk revolves around how can Democrats better appeal to Trump voters, and with the idea being that somehow the Democratic Party would reestablish the coalition it had in 1968 with Robert Kennedy, meaning working class people, minorities, as well as so-called urban elites. Now, your work would seem to suggest maybe a different approach. What would you say to Democratic strategists who are looking ahead to the next presidential election and want to win?
You will not win by trying to appeal to those where racism is their driver.
But are you suggesting that the entire Trump vote is racist, that the entire Trump vote is not to be impinged upon by Democratic appeal?
What I mean is that when we have a party, a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-class party that is then trying to make an appeal to those who believe that babies should be in cages, who believe that it is okay for police to shoot unarmed black people, who believe that there was nothing wrong that happened in Charlottesville, then how do you find that middle ground? You can't. You can't. You can't.
That's what I'm asking. In other words, how do you appeal to voters who say, look, I don't want to see mothers separated from children at the border, but there needs to be some rational immigration policy that's not open borders? And I'm posing this question like a certain kind of voter. Where do I go?
I remember seeing this article in Vox that went to, I think it was Whitley, Kentucky, where people were on the Affordable Care Act. And 80% voted for Trump. And the first question was, so how's your life changed by having access to health insurance? And they were raving about it. And then the reporter said, but you know that the Republicans want to do away with the Affordable Care Act. And they're like, yeah, we heard them say it, but they don't mean it. And they're like, no, they really do mean it. And then came the piece. Yeah, but you know, there are those other people.
Yeah.
And they've got better health insurance than we do. And they don't deserve it.
Well, and now we're back to the subject that we started with, which is white rage.
Mm-hmm.
How does white rage, which has been a more or less a constant in American life,
yes.
How does it be eradicated? How does it burn itself out?
Whites really have to have the conversation with whites about how this thing really works, about the damage that it really does, and how it violates every principle that they say they hold dear. For instance, we spent $1 trillion on the war on drugs, basically to have mass incarceration of black people and brown people. And we know that the war on drugs doesn't work. It didn't work. But could you imagine what we could have done with that $1 trillion in terms of providing affordable access to college or affordable access to health care, or what we could have done for infrastructure and retraining for a green economy? I mean, these are the kinds of things that are life-changing. But when we focus in on that zero-sum game, that's when we do damage. White rage does damage. And we have to understand the depth of that damage.
Dr. Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate this conversation.
Carol Anderson is a professor at Emory University. And if you're interested, we did a long segment about voter fraud just about a year ago. And you can find that link on our Twitter feed at New Yorker Radio. Ahead this hour, our food correspondent Helen Rosner has been experimenting with fermentation. Sounds like one of those don't try this at home scenarios, but that's exactly what she did. She tried it at home, and she wants me to sample the results, so wish me well. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi continues to roil Washington and much of the world. The president, for his part, stands firmly behind Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Donald Trump has claimed that we don't really know if bin Salman was implicated in the murder or not, dismissing the CIA's own conclusion that he was. But the thrust of Trump's reasoning is that the Saudi government is, after all, our ally, and it's just not our business who they kill. It's also not good business. Earlier this year, Dexter Filkins published a long article in the magazine about bin Salman, how he had consolidated his power, how he was going to take power very soon, and his relationship with the Trump administration was also discussed. And what Dexter found was extremely troubling. I talked with Dexter in April, and at that time, bin Salman was still being widely hailed as the great modernizer of Saudi Arabia, and he was making a huge impression on the world stage.
As somebody put it to me, an American diplomat, we're used to, you know, when we get on the phone with the king of Saudi Arabia, he's 85 years old and he's kind of half asleep and he mumbles a lot. And then the phone call's over. And this guy talks, you know, he's engaged.
He's 32 years old.
He's 32 years old. He's ambitious. He's impatient. He's charming. He's charismatic. He's tall. He's on the make.
So even as crown prince, MBS has been making some liberalizing moves. He's promised to overhaul the Saudi economy. He's lifted restrictions, including women driving. Is he offering real reform?
Yes, it's important to distinguish what kind of reforms. He definitely wants to open up the economy. There's a lot of economic reforms that he's initiated. He's trying to restrain the clergy. He's letting women drive. The one thing that's not on the table is political reform. That this is all about saving the House of Saud.
And maintaining power. So what is the economic predicament of Saudi Arabia?
It's pretty dire.
We think of them as just magnificently wealthy.
And they are. But they're burning cash at an extraordinary rate. And it's a vast welfare state where almost everything is subsidized from food to gasoline to education to healthcare, housing. But what's happening is that the whole economy was built on the idea that oil would be about $100 a barrel. And so they're just basically burning through their savings. And so as somebody put it to me in the story, at current trends, in 5 to 7 years, Saudi Arabia is broke. They're running out of money.
Unless they do what? Because I don't expect that in 5 to 7 years, the petro economy will disappear.
It won't disappear, but they can't sustain what they have. They don't export anything else. They import virtually everything else. So they've got to diversify. They got to do something else.
Now, MBS has also talked about inspiring a Saudi entertainment industry. I don't normally think of Riyadh as a kind of proto-Hollywood or New York or Paris in that way.
It's amazing. He's doing it. Movie theaters, concerts, you know, with certain restraints, but he's doing it.
Well, let's get into the darker side of what's happening. Where are the main areas?
So in addition to all these things that he's done, at the very same time, he's arrested human rights leaders. He's detained journalists.
There's not going to be freedom of speech?
Absolutely not. I mean, that's just off the table. And in many ways, he's tougher than his predecessor. So he's clamping down on any kind of notion of political reform at the same time. And then, of course, we have the famous now wave of arrests when he dragged in dozens of very wealthy Saudis, even some of his relatives.
But he put them in that well-known prison, the Ritz-Carlton, which was
yes.
A very peculiar thing, no?
Very peculiar. I mean, the you know, it's a hotel for princes. It's just not generally for princes under arrest.
And maybe the main thing that happened at the Ritz-Carlton is that MBS forced any number of these people to give up either all of their assets or billions of dollars, tremendous amounts of assets, all in the name of anti-corruption. How is that done and toward what political end?
Well, you know, some of these were the richest people in the world. were suddenly locked up in the Ritz-Carlton. And so as best we understand it, when they were sitting in their hotel rooms, from which the doors had been removed and anything that could be used to harm themselves, they were interrogated and their financial documents were kind of laid out in front of them. And they negotiated and arrived at a figure. And it usually, as I understand, it wasn't all of their money. It was some of it. So you're worth $2 billion, we get a billion. And so it was kind of agreed to. And then you signed that away. Everybody kind of shook hands. And then no one spoke about it when they came out. They didn't want anything really bad to happen to them.
Did anything bad happen to them?
Looks like it. What happened? There's at least one person who died in custody, it looks like under pretty grim circumstances. But at the end of the day, MBS got $100 billion from in the big shakedown.
The Saudi government got $100 billion from it. Wow. Your piece seems to imply that MBS has been making deals with the United States, and the Trumps are pleased to be making these deals for two reasons. One for geopolitical reasons, and the other is for potentially for personal reasons. So this is more difficult to ferret out.
Yes.
Let's start with geopolitical. In the Obama administration attempted to create a kind of detente or better to say a balance of powers in the region by dealing with Iran, signing a nuclear deal, dealing with it in all the complexity that you have to deal with Iran. Now you have the Trump administration, which sees a pure friend in Saudi Arabia and a pure enemy in Iran.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, the Trump administration came in and said, this whole thing about sharing the neighborhood, which is what Obama said to the Saudis, share it. We're tearing that up. And we're going to go after Iran. And so, you know, the Iranians have essentially come to dominate, as they see it, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. They're everywhere. They're on the march. And we are going to roll them back. And I heard that phrase many times talking to people in the Trump administration, roll back the Iranians. And so in the past year, what have we seen? The Saudis and the Emiratis essentially tried to overthrow the government in Qatar. They think Qatar is too close to Iran. They tried to essentially overthrow the government in Lebanon. And then they launched this, you know, enormous and very bloody bombing campaign in Yemen, intervening in the civil war there because they see the Iranians as essentially behind
it. Which the United States assists in.
Yes, I mean—
On the Saudi side.
Yeah, I mean, the Obama White House kind of held their nose and said, okay, we'll keep sending you the bombs to drop. But they really didn't like it. And the Trump administration said, just, you know, go to it.
Dexter, you've explained the geopolitical reasons why the Trumps are going to be close to MBS and have been. There's also the personal aspect, the personal financial aspect to it. How would you break that down?
Well, this is complicated, but both the Trump and the Kushner families have financial interests in the Middle East.
So Qatar, which is home to a key American airbase, is currently the target of a blockade. Probably not by coincidence, but you tell me. Your reporting turned up evidence of a failed real estate deal between the Qataris and the Kushner family. What happened? And it seems to be a factor in the administration's attitude toward the blockade of Qatar.
It's all this is just remarkable. I'm shaking my head. The Kushner companies owns the big high rise
666 Fifth Avenue,
and with that has a mortgage of $1 billion, more than $1 billion, that's coming due soon. As I was told by a very credible source in the financial industry, the Kushner companies in April 2017 came to the Qataris in the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan
looking
for $1 billion. They asked for $1 billion.
As one does.
Yeah, as one does. They had a big plan to kind of renovate the building and kind of make it all work. And the Qataris, they have a sovereign wealth fund with $300 billion in it. They have money to burn. They looked at the deal that Kushner had kind of laid out for them, Charles Kushner, Jared's father, and said, you know, forget it. Thanks very much, but no thanks. 6 weeks later, there's a blockade announced on Qatar.
John Bolton's going to be national security advisor very soon. How do his priorities and records square with MBS?
This is going to be a very unpredictable period. I think John Bolton is on. I think he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a few years ago, essentially calling for preemptive strikes against Iran. That's just exactly the sort of thing that MBS is thinking.
MBS compares the Iranian leadership to Hitler.
Yes, this is. I mean, I had these conversations when I was in Riyadh. They said it's the Nazi ideology, and they do not merely want to dominate the Gulf. They want to destroy Saudi Arabia and conquer Saudi Arabia, and we are. It's no more Mr. Nice Guy, and so instead of what you had, I think, in the Obama administration, was they were essentially restraining the Saudis from getting into some kind of serious, maybe a shooting match with the Iranians in the Gulf. Now it's a completely different ballgame.
Dexter, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we spoke back in April. Both Dexter and Robin Wright have written a great deal about Jamal Khashoggi's killing and its repercussions, and you can find that at newyorker.com. Helen Rosner is a food correspondent for The New Yorker, not a restaurant critic. She writes about the culture of food, what people are eating, why they're eating it, why it all matters. She's always trying new stuff, and recently she experimented with fermentation. And she did so under the guidance of quite an authority on the subject, the celebrity chef Rene Redzepi. Helen, I heard you had an important visitor at your place recently. Tell me about it. What happened? What went on?
I did. I made a number of recipes from a new cookbook. The book is called The Noma Guide to Fermentation, and it's by Rene Redzepi, the chef at Noma, and David Zilber, who's the head of the Noma Fermentation Lab. So Rene came over with David Zilber. They showed up at 10 a.m. on a beautiful sunny morning.
This is a nice place.
Thank you.
I'm not used to coming to New York and seeing people live in real homes.
Yeah.
Usually they live like in...
So Noma's a really big deal, and it's in Copenhagen, right?
Yeah, it's a really big deal. It's generally considered one of the best, if not the best, restaurant in the entire world. It's one of those high-end tasting menu kind of places where you pay several hundred dollars to sit down for several hours with a number of courses that are weird and wild and wonderful.
Weird and wild and wonderful how? What do I get when I go to Noma?
Well, at Noma...
For my hundreds of dollars.
Noma is particularly famous for kind of being the locus of what has come to be known as the sense of place movement in high-end dining. So the chef, Rene Redzepi, has really turned to the landscape of Denmark and Scandinavia to find interesting ingredients and use interesting and unexpected techniques on them. He does a lot of foraging. He does a lot of getting to know the earth and the soil and the seas, and then taking what he finds there, often things that you might not expect to see on a menu, like ants, for example.
Ants,
which live
for
in
hundreds of dollars
Denmark.
For dinner.
Sure. A recent dessert at Noma was a puree of blueberries and walnuts that was beautifully plated and garnished with a few perfectly placed ants.
So Rene Redzepi gets interested in experiments and experimental ways of cooking food or presenting it in some way or another. Fermentation is something that I kind of think of when I think of, I don't know, sauerkraut?
Yeah.
It's so, not a word that leaps to mind with delicious, though, necessarily. Obviously, I'm 100% wrong.
Well, I don't like to say you're 100% wrong, but sauerkraut is not the sexiest food. But at the same time, you know, it's undeniably wonderful, right? It's tart and it's effervescent and it's sour and it's complex. But what happens at Noma a number of years ago, Rene and his team decided that fermentation was actually at the core of everything that they were doing. And they built what is sort of lovingly known as the Noma Science Bunker or the Noma Fermentation Lab.
So explain what fermentation is exactly. What is it, chemically speaking, what is it?
So chemically speaking, fermentation is the process of bacteria engaging with your food. Bacterias and yeasts, they sort of, I need it.
That sounds yummier all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah.
That sounds yummier all the time.
Good.
But it's fermentation is the chemical breakdown of a substance by
bacteria, yeast, other microorganisms. I think I got that right.
Yes, you nailed that much better
because
than
I wrote it on the back of my hand.
I know, I should
from
have
chemistry
this down
class
in front of me.
Right, usually. So you get it in yogurt, you get it in beer, you get it in cheese, even the much dread. Although I'm sure many of our listeners love kombucha.
Sure. Yeah. That
God knows why
frizzy, sour, weird flavor that's in all of these foods right. that we love and that we really respond to. Though of course there are some people who really don't like that flavor, but they'll grow into it. David had actually mailed me a couple of days ahead of time from Copenhagen a mysterious package that I was instructed to put into the refrigerator right away. And this mysterious package contained what turned out to be barley koji.
If you've ever been to a cheap college dorm room and wandered into the bathroom and noticed the ceiling covered in black mold, you've met a relative of koji. Like
so koji is an interesting thing. It sort of looks like brown slime. And while Renee and I were the ones really getting our hands dirty making these three fermented things, David was standing by ready to answer in incredible detail every single question that I had.
Beyond koji's ability to break starches into sugars, it can also break proteins into amino acids, creating the flavor of umami. And that's where it comes into play in products like
he's kind of like a mad scientist of fermentation. He knows everything.
What's it like having these two guys in your kitchen? It must be a little on the intimidating side.
I was a little bit starstruck, I'm not going to lie. you know, they're really good at what they do, which was the great thing, and I felt very at ease with them. And the thing that really blew me away through all of it was how simple all three of these recipes were. All you do is mix these things with salt or with koji, and you wait.
And something unusual and fascinating and terrific comes out of it.
Exactly. You know, fermentation is in all sorts of foods that we already eat. But if you decide to really set out to do it yourself at home with seriousness, the way this book wants you to, it involves all sorts of specialized ingredients. So you become a person who winds up buying mold on the internet or going in search of a specialty bacteria when you travel overseas. And actually, Rene Redzepi told us an incredible story about a time he was trying to travel home from Mexico with a really exciting fermentation ingredient.
They unpacked my bags. And within 5 minutes, there's like 15 machine guns around me, really. And you know what? They open one of the bags and they put their finger in, like you see in the movie, and they were like this.
They tasted it.
They thought it was drugs. And I told them, it's mold. And then when it was sweet, you know, they all laughed.
How do you get it? Like, do you scrape it off a wall or like?
No, you get it as a powder.
Okay.
Yeah, you can have these powdered up, but I guess you could scrape it off a wall.
So you can't get this stuff even at Whole Foods?
Most Japanese supermarkets will have koji available, and if you don't have a Japanese supermarket near you, you can order it online. I had the good fortune of having Noma's own homegrown barley koji. But making the hazelnut miso couldn't have been more simple.
All right, so I make hazelnut miso how?
Here's how you do it. You take hazelnut flour, you combine it with a certain amount of the barley koji, you add a little bit of salt, you pack it into a jar, and you wait.
And then I have it.
You have miso.
So after they left, you were left in charge of checking in with all this fermentation that was going on in your refrigerator, the blueberries, the hazelnut miso, and even some mushrooms.
Then I recorded an audio diary of what I found.
We have different lives.
All right, it's day three, because I forgot to do this yesterday, and I'm going to check on our three jars. So first up, we have the blueberries, and wow, there is some serious blueberry juice starting to form at the bottom of this jar.
Oh, here we are on day four, I guess.
Okay, I kind of want to give this a shake or something, but I don't want to mess anything up. It's clear that they're starting. Hey, what's wrong, sweetheart? Can I talk to my phone? Give me 1 second.
Well, here we are on the ninth day. Well, the blueberries and the mushrooms have now been going for a little bit over a week, which means it's time to test them. So I'm gonna open the jar and give them a taste, and I'll report back.
Now, Helen Rosner, we come to the crucial moment. Apparently, you've bought stuff to eat.
I did. I brought snacks.
Can I say, guests should always bring snacks. It's just the right thing to do. What do you got?
So the first thing is I brought you some yogurt and honey so we can make a little mini parfait with the blueberries.
All right. I think I've done right there. Okay. And you want and put regular old honey in
there. Yeah, just plain old honey
in the upside down little bear guy.
Yeah.
Okay. You're not joining me? Come on, Helen.
I'll have a little.
All right.
Can you pass me a spoon?
Damn right I will. Okay. Let's try this out. Mm. like that. That is weirdo, but great.
Yeah, that's my favorite of the three.
That's fantastic.
I'm a huge fan of that. And the thing that really blows my mind with this whole
process.
More? Yes, please. Here, there's spoons on the table.
It's like it's created a whole new berry.
Yeah.
I mean, they're blueberry adjacent now.
Right.
Really good. Okay. And what would you do with this? Like pancakes or?
Yeah, you can do all sorts of things. You know, in the book, they recommend running them through a blender or a food processor and kind of pureeing them and, you know, because it's very.
Yeah, I wouldn't have the patience for that. you got the blueberries, I'm eating them.
Well, once they're blended, though, they suggest really fascinating things like using it in a homemade barbecue sauce or brushing an ear of corn with it and then grilling the corn.
Fermented blueberry ground up in a food processor and smeared over a ear of corn.
Sure.
Man, I wouldn't have thought of that.
First, this is the mushrooms.
Should I open it?
If you want to, yeah. Take a whiff, too.
Take a whiff, she says.
It smells like something very specific to me, and I'm curious if it smells like the same thing to you.
Oh, it smells kind of boozy.
Yeah. I think it
boozy
smells like—
Boozy mushrooms.
I think it
what
smells
could
like
be
apple
bad?
Cider. There's something very cidery to me.
You got it.
Well, let's try what I made
with
the
mushrooms.
Okay,
now we have green beans.
This is a prepared dish. This is, you know, food TV style I came in with
I
the
really
final
should
thing.
Not have eaten lunch before this, but—
Well, so I'm giving you these in sort of— Okay, reverse order of how much I like them.
Fantastic advertising. These are green beans that have what on them?
The dressing is made out of a combination of the fermentation liquid from the mushroom, so this mushroomy, salty brine, and then an oil that I made by infusing non-fermented mushrooms in a neutral oil and a little bit of diced shallot.
Okay, this is delicious, I think largely because you cook these beans in a they're crispy and they're fantastic. Oh, this is cool. This is really good.
Yeah.
And we're going to crunchy bean sound, too. God.
You know,
all right, so now you have a package, a container of what looks like cookies.
When I started mixing the koji in with the hazelnut meal, I noticed that it felt a lot like cookie dough. And I asked Renee if you could just make cookies out of the hazelnut miso itself. And to my incredible delight, he thought it was kind of a cool idea and suggested that he and David should play around with it when they get back to the Noma kitchen.
Can you make a miso cookie?
You know what? Have we ever done that?
Miso cookies?
Yeah?
No.
Have we ever just put an egg in this and tried to bake it?
No.
Oh.
We can't.
Live Noma innovation happening in my home right now.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. Magic just
wanted.
Happened.
This is what we wanted.
The book is making
you like it.
Mmm.
You really like it.
They're really good. So my wife and I have the same affliction. We're one of those people who are always asking the waiter or for salt. This is the saltiest cookie I've ever had. Therefore, one of the best.
I am delighted and surprised that you like this. I think
I've never tasted anything like this. This was fantastic. Now, is this going to become part of your cooking regimen, fermentation?
Yeah, you know, it already was, it turned out. I'm a big fan of making things like preserved lemons, and I have definitely once or twice experimented with making my own kombucha.
Be truthful with me. It's your last hour on earth, and you've got the best kombucha possible over on your left and the best beer possible over on your right. What are you reaching for?
Well, beer is also fermented.
Yeah, I know. so much better.
It depends on the beer, and it depends on the kombucha. I'm not good at answering these questions.
You know what this leaves us with? Our next segment. Down the road. How about that?
We'll do a kombucha versus beer taste test. For
ladies
sure.
And gentlemen, Ellen Rosner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to try making those fermented hazelnut flour cookies, well, we've got the recipe at newyorkerradio.org, and best of luck. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Authorities in India are working to recover the body of an American killed on a remote island. He reportedly intended to convert the native population.
John Allen Chow was a young man filled with a sense of adventure and a calling to spread the gospel. He managed to get himself to North Sentinel Island, which is about 700 miles off the mainland of India, and he went there to preach to a group of pre-modern people who have fiercely resisted all contact with outsiders. Chow's killing by the Sentinel Islanders is bringing attention to the few uncontacted tribes left in the world.
the number of uncontacted tribes, people living truly apart from civilization as the rest of us know it, is vanishingly small and getting smaller every year. The conflicts are felt most keenly, perhaps, in the Amazon rainforest. Development brings loggers and miners into close proximity with some of the few uncontacted tribes that remain. Staff writer John Lee Anderson has covered Latin America for decades, and he knows the Amazon better than most. Even before he became a journalist, which was when he was quite young, he had taken a journey up the river called Madre de Dios.
I had an unusual upbringing. I had an inordinate admiration for people who were able to do things with their hands, to hunt, to live off the land. And from a quite young age, 11, 12, I had been trying to do it. My parents had tried to facilitate it where they could. So I spent a year in Africa when I was 13. And I'd spent a year on the Mosquito Coast, 17 and 18, living and working as a machetero, as a peasant, earning a dollar a day with Garifuna people on the coast of Honduras, and learning how to climb coconut trees and use a machete and to fish in a dugout canoe. And I had a great admiration for people that knew the forest, knew the wilderness, and could survive in it. I felt like I was a city boy wanting to learn the original secrets of life. It's funny because I realize as I'm talking about this that this is the stuff of, you know, adventure tourism and even television shows now. And it just wasn't then. I first went to the Madre de Dios when I was 20 years old. So it was in the late 70s, with an idea to go upriver to where, you know, in those days we still talked about wild Indians. And I was pretty gauche, and I thought that would be, it was something I'd always wanted to see. I wanted to see the original world. I was young. I was not yet a journalist. I had had a couple of years at college and left to go to South America to explore. So I hired a man to take me upriver into what was called the Manu Forest. It had recently been declared a national park. It's part of the river head of the Amazon in the corner of Peru, neighboring Brazil and Bolivia. It's a vast region, a kind of an amazing biosphere that is also home to some of the world's most isolated people. And I camped on a sandbar near an Amaricaire indigenous village. I'd been told that they were unfriendly and they weren't hostile, but they didn't meet my eye. You know, I knew that they were not happy at seeing me there. I now realize that what I was seeing was a community that had been devastated in the previous half century. The Amaricaire had been one of the great warrior tribes of the region. By the time I went there, there were about 500 left. I wanted to go further up. This was still the main river. I wanted to go off into the tributaries. It was like getting off from a highway onto a trail, really. And we did. We went up the Manu River, which is then into the national park. I forget whether it was our first or second night up the river, but, you know, these are long days in the canoe. And there were suddenly two men on the shore. I remember them as incredibly strong, fit men. One in particular, I'll never forget, he had this black hair. It was like a mop on his head, and it was cut ragged around his shoulders. And they were standing over a dead peccary, a wild boar. And my boatman hesitated, but we stopped. We hadn't had meat. In the end, we had a meal with these two men who were, for me, of an unknown tribe, and we had no means of communication. And they just stared at me all the time. And at one point, I remember looking across at this one man who particularly fascinated me because he was so strong looking. He'd cut off pieces, and we were eating them. And he had the actual bone, the actual shank and was holding it with his feet, and with his arms he was chewing off the rest. And I thought to myself, this is a glimpse of ancient man. There we were. That was it. I returned to the Madre de Dios this time because of the mysterious appearance over the last several years of the Mashkopiro Indians. For almost 100 years, they remained in the forest. And, you know, there were occasional appearances, but it wasn't until the last 4 or 5 years that the Mashko had been repeatedly coming out. Even adventure tourists had begun to see these people who would appear on the riverbank. In some cases, they would be threatening. In other cases, they would be just staring at them. There was an incident in going back to 2011 where they killed a man. In the years since then, they had been more and more sightings of them. And then suddenly, this last year, they killed, with a bow and arrow, a young man in a village of Machigenga Indians. Now, the extraordinary thing is, as I say, that for about 80 to 100 years, the Mashko had disappeared into the forest. Now, suddenly, they're coming out. So anthropologists and others, the zeitgeist is full of papers and findings and debates about what's going on. Why are these people coming out? You know, they're now prey to drug traffickers, to men seeking hardwood timber, which is worth, you know, hundreds of thousands, a single tree, and so on, gold, diamonds. The speculation was that the Mashko were coming out in distress, that they were coming out because they can no longer survive inside. There was a kind of growing consensus and an alarm spreading that perhaps, you know, it is the end time for these people. So the Mashko coming out forced the government to address the situation. So that meant that the government, through its culture ministry and its recently created Office of Isolated and Uncontacted Indigenous Peoples, staffed by a handful, literally a handful of young anthropologists with almost no budget whatsoever, now were forced to consider making contact with the Mashko to find out what the problem was, why they were attacking, why they were coming out. And so they began last summer to make what they called expeditions of controlled contact. They have an outpost on the river, and through native interpreters from the Jine tribe, who are basically cousins of the Mashko, they've convinced them to make their appearances there. The outpost is up a high bluff, and there's a longhouse there with a water tank and a generator. And they have a bench on the edge of the bluff. And they spend their days looking across to see if there's any appearance by the Mashko. The first time I saw them, I saw a mass of naked people standing against the white scree of rock of the far riverbank. This was maybe the fifth or sixth they had had in such encounter. When the scouts and the anthropologists arrived on land, they were immediately besieged by the group in a friendly way, because they knew them now, particularly by the children who climbed on them. They were inspecting them. They searched their bodies. I noticed that one of the scouts, one of the Jine women working with the anthropologist, is named Nellie. She's quite a chubby woman. And I noticed that the women were sort of kneading her breasts. And then Rommel, the sort of lead Jine scout interpreter, we watched as the children sort of made him run with them and do races. Anyway, there was all of this milling around. There was a lot of playing. You could see that they were also making faces to one another. Usually this would be the children with Rommel. The adults would come up and watch this. And then sometimes they would join in too. And I could see the anthropologist asking questions.
las chiquitas. Me dicen, estás gestando, creo, ¿por qué no?
Back at the camp, back at the post, I asked Nelly what was going on.
Yo vi que te estaban revisando.
And then she said, well, they saw how fat I was, and they said, you're pregnant. And I said, no, I'm not pregnant, I'm just fat. They didn't know what that was. And one of the women said, well, I am. And she squeezed her breasts and squirted her breast milk in Nelly's face.
Así, las chicas lo hicieron así.
No les has visto, estaban ahí con sus tetas.
No me digas.
It was this kind of haphazardness. But they had begun to get a pretty much register who was who. They knew who the leader was, and he was there that day. I immediately recognized him. A young man, about 22, tall, called Camotolo. And they talk a lot about Camotolo. They say that Camotolo seems to understand that the outside world is right there, that it has certain benefits. He'd always expressed a lot of interest in their canoe. He would often go and sit in it. Two things that had emerged. The Mashko did not swim and could not fish. They had no canoes. They lived in the forest. So this is very unusual. But so far, they'd been frustrated in discovering why they were coming out. The team, you know, they worried about the fact that they weren't in full control of this idea of a kind of pure contact. The lead anthropologist, who was Luis Felipe Torres, a young guy, was full of sort of self-doubt about whether or not this was a good thing, but he didn't know what else to do. It had fallen upon them to look after these people. So, you know, here you have had a young, you know, progressive Peruvian from the city who'd learned anthropology but felt a moral quandary about whether what they were doing was ultimately right. They were having to respond to them because they had killed someone, because there was a clamor from the communities where these people had been killed that these people needed to be reined in. After this visit, for the first time I saw the kind of fragility of their existence there and their vulnerability to the outside world, because there was a doctor who was part of the group as well, and he was really concerned because he said two of the women had coughs.
This is constant, yeah. Ah, del entrenamiento. Yo puedo escuchar una tos, pero no sé si es una tos que se ha atorado, es una tos síntoma de algo, ¿no?
And he began to work on a kind of an emergency plan in case they had begun succumbing to flu. And he told me there was a 3-day rule with indigenous communities. I asked him what he meant by that. I said they begin dying within 3 days. The children in particular begin to die just like that. They drop like flies within 3 days. He said he knew that eventually there would be an epidemic and it would be devastating to the Mashko. So they agreed to come back again. We'd been waiting for them. It was the day they were supposed to come, and they didn't show, they didn't show, they didn't show. And then finally, I heard this excited roar, and there they were. But this time it was different. This time, only 3 men appeared. Camotolo, another, and a boy. And the older man walked sideways to the edge of the forest to a group of bushes, and he kind of hid himself there. The anthropologist was really worried, and he said, you know, this doesn't look good to me. They might be planning an attack. Where are the women? And he explained to me that in the history of these encounters, this kind of controlled contact thing, that in the past 40 years there have been 60 scouts killed by indigenous peoples, and usually the attacks occur at this stage in the contact. As they were getting ready to go in the boat, the women appeared and the children. What I felt I saw on this trip was a glimpse of the original world as it's ending. People are no longer metropolitan, you know, urban Americans, Peruvians everywhere are losing primary experience. We're no longer having direct contact with the original world. Where I was, it's still there. The very original world. Before all of our history. Before Columbus, before Christ, before all of that stuff. How we were when it was just us and nature. It's disappearing, and it probably will disappear, if not in our lifetimes, in our children's lifetime. It's going. The Mashcopito are coming out of the jungle. There's only 100 isolated groups left in the world. 70 of them live in this area of Peru and Brazil. This is it. This is the end. That's an extraordinary thing.
Staff writer John Lee Anderson. He traveled to the Amazon in 2016. That's our show for today, and I want to thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.